Last year, comedian Jim Gaffigan thought he might be giving up show business for good. His wife and writing partner Jeannie discovered that she had a tumor wrapped around her brainstem. But now, after a successful treatment of the tumor, both Jim and Jeannie are back with his stand-up special, Noble Ape, which Jeannie directed. The film is playing in theaters around the nation and can be seen in New York at the Village East Cinema. It is also available on streaming platforms through the Comedy Dynamics Network. In addition, Jim is performing his Fixer Upper Tour and will soon appear in, I believe, about a dozen feature films. I am so happy to have Jim Gaffigan on the show today. Hello, Jim.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
I know that you had canceled many of your shows in the wake of Jeannie's diagnosis and postponed a publicity tour. Did you get the sense at one point that you might not perform again and that you might end up staying home and taking care of your five kids?
Oh, yeah. That was a definite reality, or possibility, I should say. There was, obviously, the brain tumor was removed, so we made it through that. But then she got, a pneumonia, and it was very dark. You know, it's you're in a hospital, as many people have been, and you kind of read things on a doctor's face. And I remember thinking, that surgeon looks nervous. And so there was this moment where, I mean, we have five young children. I'm a mediocre dad, but I knew that I in the worst case scenario, I wasn't going to outsource the parenting. I was going to be a full-time mediocre dad.
And you start having those dark thoughts about what it would mean to be a single stay-at-home dad.
You start
kids.
Thinking of, and I definitely had, there was a certain piece where I was like, you know what, I was very fortunate to be able to perform the way I had and to appear in, some films and do a TV show with my wife. And so I was like, all right, so now I'm full-time dad. You know, maybe I would do stand-up around, I live in New York, so I would be able to perform occasionally around the city, but not at the level or to the frequency that, I am enjoying right now.
Sure. So there's a saying that time, that tragedy plus time equals comedy.
Yes.
Is there a rule of thumb in your household about how much time is to pass before you can start joking about this? I mean, did you start joking about the tumor at some point after the diagnosis, you and your wife?
Well, there was, the humor is a coping mechanism, as anyone who chooses to live in New York City, you have to have a sense of humor.
Yes,
and that's
that
the way
humor.
You deal with it, whether it's a horrible subway ride or whatever. I mean, it's 96 degrees. What are we doing in this?
Why do we live
in this concrete jungle? But humor was an important coping mechanism, and it's kind of how my wife and I kind of organize our thoughts and writing comedy around it. Kind of in a way took some of the power back from how powerless we felt during the diagnosis and the surgery and the recovery. I mean, the recovery still continues today. But it's also fun to write and kind of, I was thrust into this hospital environment and it was kind of being put in a different country. Mm-hmm. It's like people that work in hospitals are amazing. There's this, it's just this whole other world that, there's comedic opportunities. I mean, I spent 20 years writing food jokes and being lazy jokes. And so now I was forced with a new environment, which was the hospital and medical crisis as a topic.
Yeah, and in Noble Ape, which is hilarious, and I watched it last night. I mean, you open with talking about your wife's diagnosis,
yes.
And you talk about the hospital. Do you have to wait a certain amount of time till the danger, her life, the life-threatening nature of it has passed for you to be able to joke about it in public?
Yeah, well, there was, I mean, obviously I was, my wife had final say on me discussing this. But yeah, I mean, there was something of everything's, we're out of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
There was also, when I started touring, doing some of the material, I wasn't sure how the audience was going to respond too, because it was very personal. And, like in the past I had done jokes, as a comedian, you believe you can make anything funny. And, everyone in an audience has dealt with personal tragedy. So I wasn't sure if people were going to interpret it as disrespectful or too soon or whatever, but Luckily, I think there was an understanding and a familiarity. I think all humans deal with medical crisis of a loved one, and we have to compartmentalize it and not live in that pain or that concern or panic, because we'd never leave our houses, probably.
Right, yeah. Right. There's also something in your delivery and when you tell the audience about this. I mean, people come to the show expecting to laugh, and then you say, my wife had a brain tumor, but you have to follow that up with, I'm serious here. I'm not joking.
Yes, and there is, you know, obviously, I think, you know, people that come to my shows know that I wouldn't joke around about it if there was any risk of it still being an issue. Just as I can joke around about, you know, finding my children annoying, given that everyone knows that obviously I care and I'm an involved father. You know what I mean? I'm not an absent dad saying, you know, kids are annoying. I'm a father who finds his kids annoying because he spends a lot of time with his kids.
Right, you know? Right. Did you find yourself, your role as a dad, change a bit while she was sick? Did you have to step up in a certain way?
Oh, yeah. It was, you know, my wife is a pretty exceptional human who has, you know, birthed five children and is really, you know, she was the ultimate caretaker. You know, obviously I lived as an adult in New York City. I could get by myself, but slowly through our relationship, she was the caretaker, the ultimate caretaker in the family. And when she went through this surgery, and then afterwards I had to take the caretaking role, which is a very powerful opportunity to do something for a loved one. But it was a little out of character. You know, I'm not used to being you know, daddy daycare or in charge of everything or organizing all of it. It's, you know, people that are taking care of people that are sick or in recovery are, you know, it's a really heroic adventure that is really exhausting. And you're also, you know, in some ways you're kind of like a cheerleader for the person that's sick, and then you have to organize everything, and then you have to, you know, coordinate just getting people different places.
The logistics of five kids,
the logistics is insane.
Yeah. What are the rules in your house about making jokes about real life situations, whether it be this or anything? I mean, do the kids and your wife have total veto control over all of your jokes?
You know,
if it's about them?
Well, you know, there is a fine line about, you know, I would never embarrass my children. I mean, my comedy's not constructed on absolute irreverence or saying the most shocking thing. It's more constructed on observation, or, you know, I make myself the target a lot.
Yes.
So, but, you know, so my children, you know, sensibility wise, my children were exposed to sarcasm very early on, probably an inappropriate age. You know, you're not supposed to be sarcastic. But so humor is very important in our family. And, you know, kids are finding their way because, you know, sarcasm is covert hostility, obviously. But, you know, so humor is very important. Sometimes kids whiff, you know, like my 7-year-old is just, his sense of humor just is essentially calling me fat. But I know that there's a process of going through it.
Sure.
So,
how do you and Jeannie function as writing partners? Do you agree on what makes a good joke? Do you, you know, bounce things off each other? How does that work?
It's changed so much over the course of our relationship. You know, when we were first, you know, married, you know, we didn't have any children. So there would be writing sessions. Maybe we'd, you know, get a bottle of wine and drink wine and talk about what we think is funny. And then over the process of having five children, now it's, you know, sometimes it's we travel together as a family and I'll do a show and we'll have a babysitter. And then after that show, we'll discuss, that will be the writing session at the restaurant afterwards. And she'll say, I really don't like this, or what about this? But she's been, you know, she's been subjected to my sensibility for so long that she kind of considers herself, you know, having a PhD in the Jim Gaffigan sensibility. And she's very funny. So, you know, like every special I've done, she has a huge hand in. And, you know, she definitely will say, you're trying to communicate this and it's not coming across.
you said she's funny, but is there a difference between being a funny person, yeah, a legitimately funny person, than somebody who goes up on stage and makes a living doing this?
Well, I think, I guess it's, you know, there's so many different kind of outlets for comedy, and she's funny in her own right, and she could be funny in any scenario, but I think that also there is a unique skill in understanding what someone's attempting to communicate, because sometimes I do shows with friends all the time, and Jeannie will give them notes that are very insightful. So, like, she has a unique skill in understanding what a joke's attempting to communicate, and maybe how the audience is responding and stuff like that. And, you know, just some of it is just comedy nerddom, you know, just hanging around and understanding comedy and how an audience is responding to you saying something.
Have you written bits in the past that you were positive were going to kill, and then you got up on stage and got nothing? Crickets?
Oh, yeah.
That's definitely part of the process. Do you remember anything in particular?
I used to have, because some jokes will work in a certain scenario and not in another scenario. Look, I remember I'd been doing a bunch of shows in Brooklyn, and this is going years back, and I had a bunch of jokes on USA Today, how it's just like, you know, it's, I was reading the USA Today on a plane because I wanted people to know that I barely know how to read, you know, or like that it looks like you're, you know, reading a coloring book. And those jokes worked great in Brooklyn.
Right.
But, you know, then I would go on the road and people are like, what's wrong with USA Today? So it's, yeah, some of it is also, what are you trying to say?
Sure.
So it's different environments, but some of it is a comic idea. And I find over the course of years, you know, particularly in Noble Ape, I'm talking about very personal things and medical issues that I probably couldn't talk about 10 years ago because some of the skill set that I had, you know. And then you set assignments for yourself with each special, you know, like I'm telling stories in this special, whereas before I, you know, was very much a 90s comedian, like get to the punch.
Yeah, joke after joke. Interesting. Yeah. You were called by the Wall Street Journal the king of clean comedy.
Yes.
What do you think about that? And do you think it's more difficult sometimes to be funny without cursing in every other word?
Well, here's the thing about clean comedy. I kind of cringe when I hear that because in the end, the only adjective you want for comedy is funny. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you're any type of comedian, whether you're African American, male, female, it doesn't matter. Trans, it's just you want to be considered funny. So the clean comedy, I think comedians just kind of do the comedy they're going to do, and then later on we give adjectives to it. So sometimes people are like, it's so great that you do clean comedy. And the reality is I come from a small town in Indiana, and, you know, I curse in everyday life, but like when I'm writing comedy, it's just not in my wheelhouse to talk about the most irreverent thing. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's, and there's people that do it much better than me. And so I kind of do the comedy I do. And I also am a clean comedian because Jesus told me to be. So,
well, you know, you did talk in your most recent special about opening for the Pope.
So yes.
If you're going to bring up Jesus, I have to bring up the Pope.
That's fine.
How did that come about? Are you a practicing Catholic?
Yes, and then... I'm Catholic. My wife is, I describe her as a Shiite Catholic. But, you know, what I loved about the Pope story that I tell in the special is that, you know, over the, you know, being from the Midwest and understanding and living in the Northeast for 30 years now is, I what I love about that's joke or those series of jokes, the Pope story, is that I captured that Northeastern mentality, which is, you know, Philly, New York, Boston, which is like, there's just this anger here. And that anger and that impatience, you know, I talk about how it contributed to the founding of the United States and how that also makes people good at things because, you know, the reason if you make it in New York, you can make it anywhere is because if you're mediocre in New York, people will tell you you're mediocre. And that applies to Philadelphia, and that also applies to Boston and Providence, Rhode Island. It's just this Northeast mentality. And that's what I loved was that, you know, of course, opening for the Pope, which I really technically didn't do, occurred in Philadelphia, and I was unprepared, and the Philly audience just let me know. Like, I was booed by an audience of people that were about to see their religious leader who was going to talk to them about mercy. And I just saw the irony in it, and it just was such a fun topic to write around.
I mean, you opened for him in that you performed on the stage where he was going to appear later outside.
Essentially, I opened, then the Pointer Sisters went on, where they fired one of the sisters. I don't know how you fire a sister. Then the Pope Mobile drove in to this outdoor amphitheater that they constructed next to the Ben Franklin Parkway. And so I essentially opened for an automobile. And that's not even the first time I've opened for an automobile. I opened for Kyle Busch's NASCAR at the Iowa State Fair.
Wow.
Kyle Busch wasn't there, just his car. And so, like, there is something that's fun about chronicling the humiliation of the entertainment industry. It's just fun. And people, you know, people have business meetings like that, so I think it resonates.
What was your, I imagine you got a little bit of an audience with the Pope. Did you
introduce yourself?
Okay. Did you say, rough crowd out there? Good luck.
No, I you know, I said, you know, don't bring up the Santa Claus thing in Philadelphia.
Right.
No, but I remember I met with him, and there was some guy standing behind him talking in Italian or Spanish, because, you know, he's from Argentina, but obviously his parents are Italian. And he, I just heard him say, Comedica Americano. That's all he's, and then the Pope looked at me, and I was there with my mother-in-law, who is, like, so Catholic, she already got early admissions to heaven. And so, but, like, that's the ultimate thing to do for a son-in-law if your mother-in-law is Catholic, is getting her to meet the Pope.
Yeah, you're golden from here
right?
on out. Yeah.
Right? I can do no wrong.
Right. You have, this is not a typo, you have 13 movies coming out? Is that right?
You know, it's, I hear sometimes in interviews, I think that they're either coming out or they're being shot.
Got
so
it.
Like there's four or five, like I've shot two, and then I'm about to shoot this third one. And then there's other, you know, you
other
do these films,
the yeah.
and then I could do it 2 years ago, and then it comes out 2 years later. And they're like, what was that character like? You're like, I don't remember. Like Hotel Transylvania 3 and Chappaquiddick, and so some of them are coming out.
Tell me about Chappaquiddick, that you're playing this is a straight role.
Yes.
This is not a comedic role.
And that was an incredible opportunity. You know, just growing up, you know, I'm 52, so I, you know, Ted Kennedy and his legacy and the Kennedy legacy is, you know, it's very important. It's very interesting. And obviously, you know, the Chappaquiddick experience, I mean, a woman died. And, you know, here we are in this Me Too era that even makes the Chappaquiddick movie even more powerful. Mm-hmm. Obviously, her death is the most tragic aspect of it. But chronicling what happened during that Chappaquiddick incident was what the movie was about. But it was fascinating. I mean, I love dramatic roles. It's just, you know, people will be like, why are you doing so many dramas now? I'm like, well, it's not like I was turning them down before.
Yeah.
It's just great to get the opportunity. Acting is something that I really enjoy. And, you know, having five young children, it's really not that different from playing dress up. So, like,
sure.
In Chappaquiddick, I was playing, a U.S. attorney from Massachusetts in 1969. And that's fun.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, Jim, thank you very much.
Thank
Congratulations
you.
On all your success. I've been speaking with comedian Jim Gaffigan about his sixth comedy special called Noble Ape. This is Midday on WNYC.